approach at 200, requesting clearance for departure. Runway 09, over.
200, Pearl Harbor Tower. You are cleared runway 09.
Wind 045 at 8. SH-3 approaching from the right. Have a nice day.
All right, I'm David Gregory from Blue Underground.
And I'm Victor J. Kemper, American Society of Cinematographers.
And you're the director.
And I'm the director of photography on Final Countdown. And I'm just reminded of the original title scene with the jet taking off from a runway. And the reason it took off from the runway is that we were not yet on the carrier. And the only way they would allow us to do this shot, to have the camera close to the exhaust of the jet, was to do it from a runway on land and not on board ship. And this is the incident where we got the camera very close, and we asked the Navy people, you know, how close, where can we put this? Where will the airplane be when it comes down? So they gave us a few trial taxi runs, and we put the camera just about as close as anyone thought was safe. Finally, we feel we're set. Camera was quite low. We wanted to get the feeling that we were shooting right up the exhaust. And as the plane roared by on the first take, the moment it passed the camera location, all I saw from a distance was the camera operator, the assistant, and the camera tumbling like tumbleweed across the runway into the grass at the side. And of course, our bravery didn't help. It could have been a disaster, but no one got hurt. We reset the camera, clearly farther away than we were the first time, and that accounts for the shot not being quite as exciting as we had hoped.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Were you actually rolling film on that first
Yes. Oh, yes. But it was a great shot of the sky and the tarmac. And
various things very quickly.
Whatever. But yeah.
Mr. Lasky, I'm Richard Tyson's executive assistant.
I know you. You going with me?
No. Mr. Tyson just wanted to see you off.
Is that him in the car?
Yes.
But this land stuff was shot in Florida, is that correct?
This was all shot in Florida, yes.
That was Martin Sheen. You've worked with Martin Sheen on a couple of occasions, right?
No, just this one, actually, yes. I enjoyed working with him very much. He's really very friendly and cares a lot about what he does.
He wasn't in the Atlanta Child Murders TV film that you did?
Marty Sheen?
Yeah.
If he was, I've forgotten.
He's credited in it, yeah.
If he's credited in it, he was in. What the heck did he play in that? Oh, my God. Now I'm going to have to go research. You see, you said I remembered everything. In shots like this, where we're shooting into the helicopter, we actually have the rotors turning at a much lower speed than they would turn in flight. And using that effect of the shadows of the rotor blades, you can really simulate the feeling that you're in flight. But it was done very comfortably from the ground. Now, a lot of the air-to-ground and air-to-air was all second unit.
Mm-hmm.
There are a number of reasons for that. For one thing, some of it required being in one of the Navy jets to shoot, and that was absolutely taboo unless you've qualified by the Navy with all those centrifuge tests, and it takes quite a while, and none of us could stop shooting long enough to take the test. So I just want to add that in the shots of the helicopter in flight in the story, when we were on the ground, we also used fans to simulate air so that there was always movement in the shot. Something was moving. If it weren't the shadow of the rotor blades, we would see hair moving or parts of clothing moving in the air.
Right. And this, of course, is the USS Nimitz.
Yes, and this is the second unit shot, because at this point we were already on board the ship. Once we captured the aircraft, we were all there, because that's the prime reason for us being on board.
Mm-hmm. And you were actually on board for how long?
We were at sea for 8 days. We were on board much longer in port.
Mm-hmm.
We did quite a bit of photography in Norwalk.
Mm-hmm.
In Norfolk, rather, Virginia.
Why don't we talk about some of the restrictions that shooting on an active aircraft carrier?
Well, you know, we knew going into this thing that we were going to have restrictions, because we were guests on an operating ship, and they were out at sea for a specific purpose, which was to give the pilots their routine opportunity to do catapults and landings, or recoveries as they call them, and they have to qualify a certain number of these every month or so, and this was one of the tours that the ship was making so that the pilots could do that, and it was scheduled within our chute to take advantage of this particular tour. We were given all kinds of caveats before we went on board. Loading the equipment was a major problem, and involved using the ship's cranes to get the heavy stuff, like our generator. We had to bring a generator on board so that we wouldn't tax the ship's power or damage it in any way. But just moving equipment up and down and left and right through small passageways is one of the burdens that you have when you shoot on a ship of any kind. In addition to that, the skipper insisted on very, very strict regulations and schedule for us. And each day, a schedule would be posted that said you will be allowed to use the bridge from 0800 to 1000. And when he said till 1000, he meant wrapped and out of the way. In other words, get out of my hair. I've got Navy work to do. And this happened in almost every place we went. We had very little freedom of schedule, where if we had to run over or do another couple of takes, we couldn't always do it at that time. If we needed another take, we would probably have to come back and do it another time. So the shoot took much longer than it would have if we were, of course, on a set or in a practical location. Although this was indeed a practical location.
Do you want to talk about, we've just seen one of the aircraft landing. Do you want to talk a bit about the process and how amazing that process is of the coordination of the carrier?
Yeah, it wasn't difficult for us to shoot the recoveries or the launches, in fact. But the excitement for us, particularly on the first night that we were out at sea, they did night launches and recoveries all night long. Now, needless to say, none of us slept, not because it was noisy or that we couldn't sleep. It was because of the excitement, the adrenaline rush that we got at night, watching these aircraft come in almost pitch blackness from God knows what altitude, to see this little speck of a landing strip in the ocean. And come down and hit the deck at the right spot and have their hook catch that cable. And of course everybody's I think that every Navy man, no matter how long he's might have been on a ship, particularly an aircraft carrier, isn't excited when the aircraft comes down and that hook is hanging, waiting to catch the cable. And of course, you always pray that it catches the first cable.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't always. That's why there are three cables across the deck for every single landing. And the photography was the easiest part, because once we saw a few of the landings and launches, we knew where to put the camera. I mean, that's my job.
Mm-hmm.
And that part was easy. But what was difficult is overcoming the excitement of watching it happening and remembering that we're there to photograph it and,
right.
and document this stuff.
Kirk Douglas.
Yeah, I'm looking at Kirk now. Kirk was wonderful. His son Peter was the producer, and Kirk tried to be exceptionally helpful, of course, as any father would do. I think Kirk enjoyed the excitement of this job as much as any of us, but I think it might have been jaded just a bit, because he had been in military films before, and he'd been on carriers before, granted not a nuclear carrier nor a jet carrier. So I think the whole process was something that he's seen many times before, but I think he was nevertheless taken with the whole new excitement of the technology and the myriad of electronics that goes with getting all this stuff together and making it work and getting those planes back safely. I don't know if there weren't many women, if any, on the crew at that time. No, there were none, because we had difficulty getting our script supervisor on the shoot.
Really?
Yeah. But the Navy allowed for that at that time. Now, of course, there are women on the carriers. The responsibility of all of these people to get these men and equip aircraft back safely every time they go off, and even to launch them safely. There's so many little things that can go wrong. Even in a launch, suppose the launching cable isn't connected quite right and the aircraft doesn't attain its proper speed as it leaves the deck. It's going to wind up in the sea.
Mm-hmm.
It's very scary and it's very dangerous. I think Lloyd's of London actually considered the carrier of a flight, flight deck of a carrier is the single most dangerous spot in the world at any given moment when they're in action. And I can see that. I can see these aircraft as they turn around. The pilots cannot see if there's a stupid crewman walking around behind him, which of course they're not supposed to do.
Mm-hmm.
But it is so noisy, and they're wearing ear protectors, and you can't always hear what's going on.
And were there any casualties when you were on board?
I can't talk about the actual casualties, okay. But I can talk about an accident.
Right.
My assistant camera person, we had set up, and it's typical of the danger that the entire crew faces, and of course, one of their most severe training lessons is safety. And they must adhere to the rules. If they don't, they'd be reprimanded. Even if they're injured or hurt, they're going to be reprimanded or punished, because they've got to know better. You cannot jeopardize your life or anyone else's, and it's very easy to do on an aircraft carrier. We had set up a camera to do a low shot of aircraft being connected to the catapult and the actual first moments of the steam generator starting that cable going and leaving the shot, and then of course we cut to other shots. So we set everything up, and the camera was very, very low on a very small on a box, and my camera assistant was there fussing with it, you know, getting a lens ready or whatever, and he wasn't watching anything else, because that's not what we're trained for. And an aircraft came and turned around to come onto the launching area, And as the hot exhaust blast came out of the jet, it took him and the camera and swept them right off the deck. Now, there are safety nets on the flight deck so that men won't fall into the drink.
Yeah.
Man overboard is a big issue, too, on a carrier of that sort. You know, there's 50 feet of freeboard.
Yeah.
And that water feels hard if you fall 50 feet into the water. So, they have an extremely tight system for man overboard recoveries, and they do drills every single day.
Right.
It's a very important part of the Navy's routine. Had nothing to do with our shooting, except that part of the routine is that the Marines, who are the SPs for the Navy on board, the police, they would kidnap one of the crew as a routine thing and hide him in a compartment somewhere and then issue a man overboard drill. And of course the drill would begin, and they have only like 10 seconds for every single department to report in if there's a man missing from their ranks. And if that department doesn't know that there's a man missing, the skipper wants to know the reason why. That's why they kidnapped someone. And while we were there, they took our still photographer and kidnapped him. And of course, not only was he indignant, but he was furious. But we reported him missing on time, however. I'm proud of that. We managed to do it. You know, it may be easy for the Navy to keep track of where all their men are, but just try keeping track of 20 people on a film crew at any given moment. It's not easy.
There's some real trouble.
Can't get his tail hooked down. I think we better take him to the barricade.
Rig it. Air ops, try flying.
On the flight deck. 87-4,
you're in trouble. Can't get him hooked down. This is not a drill. This is not a drill.
It looks like it's about to happen.
It's about to happen, yeah.
This large crew of men is trained to get this capture net up in a very, very limited time. And they drill constantly for it. And what it requires, of course, is across an otherwise clean deck, they have to pull this netting, stretch it across the deck, raise it, as you see here in the picture. I don't know what material it is that those vertical pieces are made out of,
mm-hmm.
but they seem to have no trouble capturing an aircraft coming in at full tilt. And an interesting thing about aircraft coming in, they fly with the throttle on, and it's a very strange sound, especially to me who had never experienced it before. I had been in the Navy myself on a carrier in World War I, and of course those aircraft flew slowly, and the landing was not as difficult as it is now at these high speed
mm-hmm.
flying machines.
World War II, surely.
Uh-huh.
You were in.
Well, what, did I say one?
Yes.
Yes. No. No, I'm not that old.
No, I don't think so.
Yes, World War II, and they come in, and you can hear them rocking the throttle from full to pull back, and it goes whoo whoo. And I'm not sure that we actually have that sound on the track of the movie, but we should have
mm-hmm.
because it's very exciting. And the reason for it is that if the pilot misses all three cables, he's got to be in a position to jam that throttle full tilt to get off that deck again.
Right.
Or he's going to be a wet guy. And of course, we don't want to lose aircraft either.
No. Okay, we've just seen the famous storm sequence.
Yes.
And from what I understand, this was something that was done by a completely separate unit in London. Is that correct?
Yes. Well, I didn't know at the time where it was done.
Mm-hmm.
And as we were shooting the film, and we were always talking about the the effects of a time warp, and everybody had an idea, and it was exciting to talk about because some of the ideas were great. But as the picture went on, Peter started to get troubled because he knew that at the rate we were shooting, he wouldn't have money left to do the special effects. And his dad tried to give him advice. And, of course, we all had our own opinions about how it should be done, and that's the way it always works.
Well, it was credited to Maurice Binder, the guy who did the James Bond title sequences.
Right. Well, you know, I'm sure that Mr. Binder has a great special effects house and knows what he's doing. I think the problem with this is that there really was no budget left at the end of the film.
Right.
So they did... They just scrimped and scraped and came up with whatever they could. And in principle, it works.
Yeah.
You know, it's by today's standards, of course, it's relatively primitive. But
yes.
These were all opticals at the time.
Well, interestingly, I did actually write to Peter Jacques, who was the producer of on that sequence. And he wrote me back an email just saying that the sequence was actually... directed by Anton Furst, who went on to be the production designer for Batman. I think he won an Oscar for that. And it was all shot at Shepperton. And yes, indeed, it was done at the end of the filmmaking process on this picture.
Now, this is an example of, you know, recovering an aircraft that contains a disabled pilot, perhaps. Or maybe even an unconscious pilot. Because the plane can be flown from the bridge by remote. It's quite amazing to see, you know, here it looks like a toy. When you see it on a small screen, it looks like a toy went into a net. But to see this in real life, to see this gigantic airplane come in and be stopped as though it were a feather by this net that they've put up. It's just, it's amazing. It's an experience I certainly will never forget.
So I assume you weren't able to sort of prepare your shots before you actually went on board. This would have been something you would have had to have actually figured out while you were there, while the action was happening.
That's exactly right. And that all started with that very first night, when we all stayed awake and could hardly work the following day. We were so tired. But the adrenaline kept us going because it was... The excitement never stops on the deck of the carrier.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, when it got a little more normal, it was stuff like inside compartments and passageways. You might as well be on a set. And all this. We used no sets to simulate the interior of the ship. We did it all on board, which presented a challenge for me, and I think it added to the reality of the scenes as well.
Yeah.
You know, production designers get to worry about where you're going to put the camera, which they should, and, you know, what lens you might be using. And as a result, it makes it a little easier when you go on a set to shoot. But here, we have no choices. The passageways are just this wide. We cannot remove walls. We cannot hide lighting. There's no place to do that. You have to be ingenious to work in conditions like this. And that's why I love the business. That's the kind of thing that really kept me going through all the years that I've shot. The challenge of each new location, making it work. You can plan all you want, but until you see a location of this sort in particular, there's no way to preconceive how you're going to do the shot,
right,
or light it. And the same challenge goes for the director. Never having been on this carrier before, there's no way the director is going to know how to stage his action. So
yes, I imagine with the limited amount that you had, a limited amount of time, and you really were under pressure.
On top of that, the skipper gave us a severe time limitation. So.
But it would seem that you got quite a lot of coverage, because, I mean, there's a lot of...
But this stuff was going on all the time, and we just rolled for, like, all of this background stuff. Everything that was shot on board the carrier was shot by the first unit.
Mm-hmm.
all of the stuff that was air-to-air, air-to-ground, with only a few exceptions, was shot by second unit. And that was a practical matter.
Sakes, Chief, all we want to know is what's going on.
Whatever it is, you'll be told.
When?
As soon as the skipper's ready.
This is the final thing on my mind. I just want to mention our sleeping, our quarters. They gave us the same quarters that the pilots would have, which is directly below the flight deck. Now, my compartment was directly below the blast fence that comes up and down, right under where the planes are hooked onto the cable for launch. And of course, there's quite a roar because as each aircraft turns into position and gets hooked onto the cable, he then, on signal, revs his engines up full blast. And a fence comes up. It's a big metal piece of the deck that just comes up and almost vertical to the blast, to the exhaust. And that's to keep it from damaging anything, you know, behind on the deck. And since my quarters were directly below that, what I heard that first night that I got to bed was this clanking, gigantic piece of metal going up and down all night long as these aircraft came into position. And the fence would come up, and then the pilot would rev full blast, and we would hear this terrible roar, and this goes on all night. As fast as they could launch, another aircraft was ready to roll in and hook to the cable again. But that's not really the end of the story, because on every subsequent night, I had absolutely no trouble sleeping.
Really?
It didn't bother me at all after that.
Wow. So you
Yeah, my head was able to get used to it.
But the signal strength is very weak.
Has anyone you interviewed talked about the chain of the exhaust cooling water for the reactors?
No.
It's very interesting. It has nothing to do with shooting or producing a film, but I found it fascinating. There's so many anti-nuke people in the world that they even resent the fact that we have carriers that are propelled by nuclear energy. And yet these gigantic cities that are really machines are designed so carefully. They use fresh water to cool the reactors, containers for the reactors. And the reason is that salt water would simply erode the metal.
Right.
So they have to use fresh water, and they take on a gigantic amount at first, you know, when they leave port. But the hottest water, which I guess is hotter than I would want to know. They never told me how hot the water actually gets. That hot water is used to distill salt water to make more fresh water.
Right.
And then it passes down an interesting chain, and I may have missed a step here or there, but it goes from there, I believe, to the laundry. After it's used to distill salt water, of course, it loses some heat, so it gets a little cooler. Then it goes into a laundry, and it's used to wash clothes and whatever. Then it goes to the kitchen
for to wash dishes
and flatware or whatever. Then it goes into the shower bathing system for the men. And I understand by the time it's expelled into the sea that it's only a couple of degrees above sea temperature.
Really?
Now, that's pretty damn swift.
Yeah.
If you stop
and
think about it. It's very exciting.
destruction of armament to such a point and in...
Now let's talk about the Gatsby. This is the ship, of course, within the time warp.
Yeah.
It's a private boat. I must confess I've forgotten the name of the owner, who was very particular about the way we handled it and treated it. So, and he knew we had to blow it up.
Mm-hmm.
At the end of the picture, you know, at the end of the sequence, yes. We had, I don't know if it was a production designer or someone in the art department, they went out and they found an old boat that was similar. Had it, you know, same shape hull and that sort of thing. And one side of it had been destroyed. For whatever reason, they found it in a dry dock or up on a rest somewhere. And they bought that and refurbished one side of it to look exactly like the Gatsby in the scene.
Yeah.
So of course, at the time when the Zeros came in to strafe it and blow it up, we only photographed the
good side.
The one side, yeah.
And so was that...
And the ship was never down. We never touched this. It was able to float.
Oh,
it's
I see.
Just
it
that there was no...
Restored.
Oh, yeah. It was awful. I mean, it was a mess. It was the wrong boat. I mean, it's just... It wouldn't have matched anyway on the other side.
What's he doing?
Oh, sure.
Arthur, have another drink. Stop thinking about how much everybody else is getting.
Thanks.
See you later.
He swung it, Laurel. How about that? He really swung it.
Did you tell him you were sleeping with me?
What?
Laurel.
Mrs. Catherine Ross and Charles
Durning. Oh, Catherine Ross is wonderful, and so is Charlie.
Durning you'd worked with before on Dog Day Afternoon.
On Dog Day Afternoon, right. He was a detective yelling at Al Pacino.
You're a strange girl, Laurel. You give more back talk and less cooperation than any girl on Capitol Hill. I don't know why I put up with you and your dog. I don't know why I just don't fire you.
Because I'm the best political assistant you'll find, and you're still more interested in politics than sex. Charlie, what is he barking at? Charlie, what is it? Listen.
These sequences shot
all off of Florida coast. I don't think you'd see water like this off of Norfolk, Virginia.
I just kept them a close sequence. I want inquiries made as soon as we return.
Yes, sir.
So how long was the duration of the entire shoot? I mean, what sort of time did you spend when you weren't on the Nimitz on this picture?
Well, let's see. I think we're on the Nimitz in port for about a week and a half or two, and then 8 days at sea.
Mm-hmm.
The rest of the time we were not all of the rest of the time. We shot around Norfolk for various shots, but all of the sea shots and beach shots were done in Key West.
Right.
There's the blast vent. See it coming up?
Mm-hmm.
Behind there. Can you imagine having that thing over your head up and down all night? There it goes. See, the importance of that is if you had watched that shot carefully, you can actually see when it disconnects from the cable. But at that point, he's got to be at full thrust.
Mm-hmm.
With his jets, or he's just going to go right down.
Straight into the drink. Yeah.
It's quite a scale. It's quite a different way of flying than Piper Cub, let's say.
Now, how would you like this sequence where you've got the...
Very carefully. Okay. All of this is done in port. There's no way that the skipper's going to be able to walk around in one of our scenes while they're at sea. So this is all Well, no, this isn't. I'm sorry. I beg your pardon. This is not in port at all because there's aircraft on board.
Right, and the aircraft aren't on board when they're in port.
Yeah, the aircraft are never on board a carrier when it's in port. But for two reasons. One, they can't get it off in an emergency. There's no way to launch off of a flight deck in port. Not enough clearance anywhere. And the other is the pilots have to train. They continue to fly out of the land-based fields.
Captain, we're getting something you might want to hear.
In the plot room.
Aye, sir.
General von Bock were reported 200 miles from Moscow, and long-range artillery fire was heard in the suburbs.
There's Peter. I almost missed him.
What the hell's going on here?
Sir, I think you ought to see these aerial reconnaissance photographs of Pearl Harbor.
Turn that off.
Yes, sir.
That'll be all. You.
You know, I've forgotten what... What a hairdo he's wearing there.
Kirk?
Yeah. It's bothering me now. It didn't seem to bother. I don't even remember commenting about it when I shot the film. I really like Kirk. He's a good man. And here's Peter again.
Yeah. Peter has his dialogue scene here.
You think the producer would give himself more than two stripes, wouldn't you?
The Russians, us, even the Germans. We've finally done it.
Done what, for Christ's sake?
War. We're at war.
You always talking shit.
So in the cases where you're in the interior of the Nimitz, then this will be the stuff that you actually shot while you were in port.
Yes. Yes. We couldn't have occupied all of these compartments. A lot of them were working areas, you know, that are required during a cruise.
And what kind of restrictions did you have when you were in port? I mean, how did that compare to actually being at sea?
When we were in port, we had very few restrictions in terms of the time we could spend in any given place. Yeah. We still had Navy restrictions about, you know, protocol on the ship and Navy rules and when you break for meals and, you know, that kind of thing. You know, in the crew mess hall most of the time. Very often we ate in the officer's mess. And the officers have to pay for their food.
Yeah.
So, of course, the company had to pay for our food as well. But then I remember the petty officers. They have their own mess. And, they invited us. They wanted to vie with the officers for our company. And they actually started to have a little contest on, the chefs did, about the food. Who was going to serve us the better food? So we kind of benefited from some pretty good chow at that time. I mean, it wasn't like eating at the Four Seasons, but It was really quite good and a lot of fun.
Two bogeys at low altitude. Distance 125 miles.
Have our fighters take an ID pass.
I can.
Have our fighters investigate and identify the contact 090, signal busted.
Hi, sir. Alert 1, this is Eagle Control.
Here's a refueling shot.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of, you know, again, to watch this on a screen like this, it's almost like toys, you know. But the whole system is so almost unbelievable to think that, number one, an aircraft with big enough tanks to be able to refuel a few other aircraft in flight, you know, one right after the other, without having to go back and re-tank up himself. And to see the precision with which that probe goes out and mates mates with the receiving aircraft, and the fuel pumps in it. It's very fast. They must have gigantic pumps because that it doesn't take long to fill the tanks. And then they're off and they're on their own for another few hours.
Alert one, this is Eagle One.
What have you got?
Two Japanese Zeros, sir.
Two what?
Two trophy class Mitsubishi A6Ms in original condition.
As a side note, my wife had a cousin who was a pilot in the Air Force for a long time, and he got hit. He took a missile up his port jet exhaust,
mm-hmm.
and it was in during the Vietnam War. And he was trying to make it back, but of course the fuel was spilling out of the tubes that were wrecked when that thing blew up. And he was really struggling along and wondering, and through radio contact somehow a tanker spotted him because he was running low, and he sends the probe out, and it was the wrong probe. It didn't match his aircraft. So I mean, these are things that who would think about that anyway. That plane went down. Years later he was working for McDonnell Douglas, I believe, in Texas, and he had become a test pilot. And one day they found a piece of crap in somewhere in Vietnam. They brought it back. They'd like to reconstruct it and see if it'll fly again. And it was his aircraft, the one that went down.
Really?
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
And then they asked him, when they got it all fixed, they asked him to test fly it. He was a little nervous about that.
But did he do it?
Yeah.
Get a clear picture of all this. Let's go to CIC.
You know, this is before the days we knew about what the sun could do to your skin with cancer and stuff. See the way Charlie Durning's sitting there with his head back?
Yeah.
Facing old Saul?
There they are.
Yes, we're about to see the one angle, I think, of the boat where it's, where it's restored and then blown up.
These guys were great. They belonged to a flying group, and I forget the name of it, actually. But they collect and fly these old aircraft. And they weren't really Zeros, but they fixed them up to look like Zero. And this is all done on a gimbal, right on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
All these shots. Not this. But close-ups of the pilots looking down, all down on the ground with a smoke machine blowing clouds past the cockpit. The old standard tricks. I saw Catherine recently at the memorial service for one of her exes. Conrad Hall was a cinematographer. Was married to her for a while.
She doesn't do too much acting these days, does she? She was in Donnie Darko.
I think it's time to abandon ship, guys. Don't you?
Yeah. Looks like danger.
We gotta get off this boat. Come on, Laurel.
I wonder if the audience got the connection at the end of the film that it was Tarantino in the car in the opening scene.
Oh, I think they did.
Do you?
Yeah, I do. Because they make
I've always wondered about that.
Because they make such a big deal out of the fact that Sheen can't see him.
Yes.
You know, that.
Yeah, well, that was the point that they hoped would make the scene work.
Right.
Making that point was good.
Yeah, no, that was the key.
But the people remember that, you know, after an hour and a half.
Well, the dialogue is such that they make him an important figure by saying, he came to see you. you know, you're not to see him.
Yes.
So they really call attention to it.
For God's sake,
get negative.
Charlie!
No! Charlie! Stop now! Come on! Those planes are coming in!
And this is stuff that was shot by a second unit.
Yes, that's correct. Anything that's air-to-air is second unit.
Survivors?
Stand by. Affirmative. 1, 2, 3 Main West. Hey, wait a minute. Those bastards are turning back. They're going to spank them into water. Request permission to fire.
This is Eagle One. You are cleared to arm, but do not fire.
Throw them off. Play with them, but don't fire. Affirmative.
All right. So what do you think about the concept, of this, of essentially two Japanese pilots from 1941 all of a sudden being...
Oh, I like it. I mean, I love stories like this. I love the mystique of it. And if you can just cut yourself off from reality when you're watching a movie of this type, like a time warp, and say, what a great idea, if it could happen. It's really a great idea.
Harvey! He's dead.
So they're actually swimming in the ocean. This isn't shot in any tank or anything.
Oh, no, this is in the ocean.
This is in the ocean.
Yeah.
So,
I think those zeros are going to get out of there. They're going to be in trouble. Can you imagine being a pilot of a propeller-driven craft like this at that time and seeing these machines flying at possibly the speed of sound?
Exactly.
With weapons. You got to know your goose is cooked.
That's right. I got to be thinking, wow, the U.S. has been keeping some stuff quiet.
Yeah. Actually going to try bullets against this guy.
So is this the sort of photography you would have wanted to do? Were you,
oh, sure.
Were you able to?
Oh yes. I've done a lot of air-to-air and air-to-ground.
You've done it subsequently?
But to be able to, you know, for the Zeros, which are propeller craft, they fly slow enough so that you can get into a camera plane that can fly in front of them, for instance, like these shots. But what about the jets?
Yeah.
I mean, can you imagine being in what would be a really slow machine with these guys coming up behind you? I mean, there's no way. So what they had to do, I understand, I mean, I wasn't part of it, but the jets had to throttle back to dangerously close to stall speed, and the camera plane was full throttle all the time, just pumping and huffing and puffing to keep ahead, you know. Side shots weren't so bad because, you know, they could do flybys and the jets would slow down for the flybys. But in cases where they had to do a maneuver, there was no slowing down. They couldn't possibly risk losing speed. So I don't know quite how they worked those out.
Splash the Zeros. I say again, splash the Zeros.
Yes, sir.
This has got to be a dream.
That's another concept. The wings just adjusted inward.
Yeah.
Could imagine the pilots of like the Zeros seeing that happen. I'm wondering, what the heck is this thing? God. But I like this air-to-air. It's very well done. I mean, it's all good stuff. Hope you can swim, Charlie.
Was that one of your shots?
No.
No.
No, all of this sequence was done by second unit.
Right.
They wasted two beautiful zeros through this.
It's the movies.
Okay. You see the attitude of the air? You see him? He's got his nose up a little bit, and he's kind of... He's probably got his flaps out. Everything's to slow him down. These are phenomenal aircraft, too. These, I forget, what do they call them? AWACS? I forget their terminology. But there are four of them on each carrier. And they can go out in the four quadrants, you know, the assuming you're heading north, it would be, you know, northeast, south, east, and west. And so that as the aircraft carrier moves 200 miles out, they have these aircraft with radar that can relay signals in. So, in effect, they can see an awful lot of ocean. Right in the bridge of the ship where the skipper's located.
Right.
So I mean that's how they can tell if they're going to be in trouble or not, or if anything's coming.
Now this sequence where you're lifting Charles Durning and
yes,
Shepard Ross.
This we did. This is a first unit.
Right.
You can see we're close to shore. Look at the color of the water there. But, and Catherine was really game. She did this rescue herself. I mean, she was in the water like this. Go get her, Tarantino.
Farentino.
Huh? Oh, Farentino, right. I got the wrong one. That's the other guy.
That's right.
Who's making movies. I'd like to know how the dog got up on that floating piece of wood.
Oh, you saw him climb up on the floating piece of wood, I think.
Not easy.
I think Catherine helped him.
Right.
Okay, so this is actually Catherine being rescued.
Yes.
Catherine, the actress.
I know that it's SOP. For the rescuer to keep the head of the victim, you know, against his chest like that.
Mm-hmm.
But I wish he had opened his hand a couple of moments just so we could see her there and be sure that it was her coming up, because it was.
Well, you got it all in one
and
shot.
I have to, yeah, but I have to hand it to her. You know, she was game to do this.
Yes.
Charlie Durning was not so brave about it.
No?
No.
He had a stuntman do it. Yeah.
Well, till the very end. I think the last moment when we swung him in. So now we're back on the ground. Well, was I standing out here on the skid taking this? I can't remember.
Yeah, up in midair, I think so.
You know, when I was young, I did those stupid things.
Did it?
When I was in helicopters, yeah, doing commercials a lot.
But hanging out and shooting out?
I would never stand on the skid, no, but I've sat out on the skid, and we didn't even have proper safety belts at that time. Nor did I have a tie off for the camera. I just had a...
You were just hanging on to
the camera, yeah.
Wow.
One day my wife found out that I did that. In fact, she saw me. And I still don't hear the end of it.
And was that the end of it for you?
I stopped. Well, I had... You know, we had babies at that time. Pretty stupid to risk your life.
For the shot.
Yeah. But young men are macho, you know.
That's right.
Anything for the cause.
Watch yourself. Watch your head.
So you mentioned earlier that you had trouble with getting the script supervisor on board. Just exactly how?
Well, I didn't. You know, the company.
The crew did. Yeah.
Yeah, it was just against Navy regulations. They worked it out, however.
But that means that they only allowed a certain amount of film crew people actually on the ship. Do you remember how many?
Well, we had what we needed. I mean, I was not restricted by the number of electricians or grips that I could have. Well, I shouldn't say I wasn't restricted, I mean, but I didn't go nuts, let's put it that way, in terms of selecting how many crew. We knew the work would be hard, not necessarily physically trying, but logistically hard. And it would take a lot of people just to get a piece of equipment, say, from the deck below the bridge up to the bridge, because a little tiny circular ladder, you know, that would go up and... It was very difficult to maneuver. The crew was just great, and I think the adrenaline rush that we all had helped everybody stay alive and, you know, stay interested in the job.
Mm-hmm. So the red cast that you've got over this,
we had to add to that, because in many cases the amount of light they had wasn't enough for the film. The speed of which was much slower then than it is today.
Mm-hmm.
Today I would not have had to add as much. But this is the way the bridge looks at, under these conditions.
Zelaski. Gentlemen?
Captain's off the bridge.
But wouldn't you have to use the fact that, you know, they have their fluorescent lights on? You would have to actually use those fluorescent
lights. Well, I did here in this case. Wherever you see a practical light in the shot, I had to simulate that color with my lighting. Sometimes I would simulate it with identical fluorescent tubes and fluorescent fixtures.
I see. Yeah.
Other times it would be incandescent lamps with a compensating filter on them to change the color to the fluorescence. Difficulty with fluorescence is that they have very, very, very high green spectrum spikes in the lighting. Not everybody will understand what spikes are, but no matter. It's not like the entire light is green. It has many, many colors within it. And the green spikes are in very strange spots on the spectrum. And unfortunately, it's a spot on the spectrum that the film responds to very well, and it's hard to filter that out, and it's very hard to correct that in post-production when you're timing the final film.
Yeah.
It's a bit easier today with digital technology, but even then you can't correct it fully.
How can I go back in history and meet my very own grandfather?
I'm not half the theorist you are, Mr. Lasky.
Even James Frantino and everybody was young. I don't understand it. They're not young now. What happened?
Ron O'Neill here. And here they're having the classic conversation about time travel, and Martin Sheen's talking about going back to, if he shoots his grandfather, will he be born? And the things that always run through your head when you watch time travel.
When we were shooting the film, I learned the song, I'm My Own Grandpa. Had you ever heard that?
No.
Oh, it's great.
Now, hold it. All right. Now, let's all calm down. Let's take it one step at a time and buy the book.
So essentially, by having to set up in these really cramped environments...
This particular compartment was a luxury.
You wouldn't be thinking that that's fine Jesus. I prefer to be in a studio. Obviously not.
Oh, no. No, never. Well, I guess we really never thought about it because it was a foregone impossibility. You know, here we were on a ship and here's where we had to shoot. But what's interesting here is, you know, shots like this where people are walking in and out of doors and up and down corridors, it didn't take long to get a system worked out. because all the corridors look alike on a ship, and all the doorways, you know, hatchways look the same. The difficulty was in some of the compartments, the conditions were different for whatever reason they were designed that way. And then we had to improvise again, you know, which, of course, is fun. Now, this is all in port.
Mm-hmm. I assume you didn't take the dog out to sea with you.
Oh, no.
Now, of course, the other thing would be that you weren't...
We had a couple of sea dogs with us, but...
But that's it.
That was it, yeah.
You wouldn't be able to, you know, drill any holes or anything like that for your lifting rigs or
not
anything
a chance.
Like that.
No. Everything was ingenuity. The grip was on his toes every moment. And it was snap judgments all the time. We could not plan ahead to the next day. We could not survey a layout or set for the following day's shoot. We got there. We brought whatever equipment we could anticipate we needed and then improvised.
Mm-hmm. And make sure you got everything that you needed.
And we got it done within the time schedule the skipper gave us. So.
So how often would you have to do drills during the day?
Oh, sometimes there were two, like a man overboard. Mm-hmm. Sometimes there were two.
Mm-hmm.
There was always at least one that I remember. But they're very important part of the Navy routine, as they should be.
Yeah. How long... you were actually brought onto this project quite late, weren't you?
Yes, I had no prep. No prep at all.
Which I suppose under the circumstances probably didn't really make that much difference because of the fact that you had to improvise anyway.
Well, except it would have been nice if I knew the story a little better and knew the director's intentions a little better and was able to spend time at the cast readings of the script so that I'd get a feel of what they were going to do and how they were going to deal with the scenes. I find that those sessions are extremely helpful for me as a cinematographer.
Did you find during this period of your career that you would get to do that usually? It was just...
I would get to do that always. Really? I mean, that's... Mm-hmm. It was always part of the routine mm-hmm. when you were hired. Like scouting locations, we never had an opportunity to do that. I don't know why the cameraman that was, I think he was on for 8 weeks of preparation. And I have no idea why he was replaced. I didn't know him and I never questioned why he was replaced.
Yeah.
But I am glad to have had this opportunity because it was a wonderful project.
Mm-hmm. There was, just so people know, there was another director of photography attached to the project, but from what I understand from one of the special effects people, they weren't too happy with the way he was filming the interior when rain was coming down on the exterior. Now that's just something that one of the special effects people told me, so that could, you know, who knows if that's correct. But
yeah, but that's interesting. I don't what was he photographing?
It was probably the preparation of the storm, I suppose.
Oh, because I don't believe any of the shots were cut into the film.
No, I don't think they were. I think
that's why I'm confused about what he might have shot. Unless they were tests.
They could have been tests.
Yeah, the chances are that they wanted to do some tests up front mm. and allowed him to do that. It's always sad when someone's on a film. I mean, I try to put myself in those shoes. If I were hired and I was working in preparation for 8 weeks and was fired before we ever shot one scene for the movie, I find that pretty depressing, I have to say. But I understand it was someone who had no experience with features at all. And shooting features is quite a different animal.
And being ready to hit back.
Obviously, we are.
God damn it.
Anything? Whoever he is, he's either too scared or too well-briefed to talk about it. Excuse me.
All right, Corporal.
Commander! I demand to know why we're being tried to...
This is the killing field here, huh?
Yeah. So the director of this picture, of course, was Don Taylor.
Yes.
How was he to work with, seeing as you didn't have any preparation?
Don was fine. You know, he understood that I was under the gun with very extreme conditions, and I think he was patient. You know, until I got the lay of the land. He was a very nice man. He's not with us any longer.
No. Peter Douglas, the producer, he was pretty much there the whole time you were shooting the film.
Well, he was on board the ship, yeah, but he wasn't there the whole time we shot in port.
Right.
I mean, I'm sure he was in Norfolk, but I mean, he wasn't always on the ship. But he had, you know, that's not the producer's job. It's he's got things to do, like see if he's got enough money. Got to be out there all the time.
Yeah.
I think the realization of falling short in cash to do everything he wanted to do came while we were shooting in port, actually. Because I remember in shots like this, night shot here, where we were in the bridge, and I was trying to decide how I was going to deal with the windows for the mat shots. Usually in those days we'd put blue mat paper up on the windows so that they could easily cut a mat.
Mm-hmm.
And there was so much conversation going on about the alternatives, and there just was not a plan. And ultimately I went with the blue because I knew it would work. Somebody had to make that decision at that moment. So I figured regardless of what optical system or shots they would make, it would work as a blue mat.
Now, aside from the fact that obviously you appreciated the opportunity to shoot on the Nimitz, would you have welcomed the possibility of actually doing these interiors in the studio?
Oh, no.
You'd rather have the challenge
of course.
Doing it there and then.
Do them in a studio, then anybody could do them. And if you do it in the studio, you can always get another shot at it. We didn't have that luxury.
Right.
And that kind of challenge is always invigorating and energizing.
Yes, the sort of one-shot opportunity. There's no option but to get it right.
Right.
Yeah.
When we were in port, clearly we had to do something. If we were doing a shot over the skipper's shoulder looking down at the deck, we couldn't even shoot out the windows because there were no aircraft on board. So we had to block the windows out, and I used paper that was translucent,
mm-hmm.
to allow daylight to come in and get rid of the hard sunlight, which would have been a big distraction, and it would always be different when the ship's standing still in port. And it made for a relatively dull view when you're looking out the windows. So if you'll notice, at those times when we were in port, we tried to avoid seeing the windows, even though we were using them as a light source, because of the brightness. And it was bright almost every day there. We had no problem with that. That's a trick we use even on practical occasions where you have to do that. Sometimes you can't get enough light inside to match either the intensity or the color quality of daylight. So we correct the windows to a point where they're just bright enough to kind of burn out, to give the image that it's so bright that you wouldn't be able to see any detail outside anyway. So you shoot into the paper and color correct it to match whatever lighting we're using inside. That's a typical trick. It's not one of mine.
Why don't you tell him what's going on here, Commander? You're an expert on what's going to happen tomorrow. Why don't you tell him about it, for God's sakes? Go on, tell him. We got nothing to lose.
Vic?
Yes, sir.
Go ahead.
Tell him.
26 November, six carriers left the Kor Isles, north of Japan.
Did you find that the actors were okay with you know, the strict discipline of being on the Nimitz?
I think they enjoyed it.
Really?
Just as I did. I think for all of us, cast and crew alike, it was such a unique experience that we, you know, we saw something new, we learned something different every day. What I liked the most was learning about the ship. I just, you know, I was entranced with the little tidbits of information I'd pick up about, like the seawater temperature, like the cooling water temperature, for instance. You know, doesn't really matter to me as a cinematographer, but I sure love it as a fact. And the equipment intrigued me. I was a television engineer before I became a cinematographer, and I actually designed and built circuitry for television equipment, mostly switching and fading equipment, which we used to call it on the console. And so technology is in my blood, and to go aboard a ship like this and to see it equipped better than any television studio or radio station I had ever been in my life was mind-boggling. And I had to know about it. And of course, they wouldn't tell me about some of it.
Mm-hmm.
In my days, IFF was the big secret gear. And in the Navy, that's what I did. I worked on IFF equipment, identification friend or foe. And it was in every craft we owned in the military. And when I would ask about some of this new stuff and they wouldn't tell me, you know, I didn't get upset because I knew I was in that position once when somebody said, well, what is this thing you're building here do? Sorry, Charlie.
Did you ask them up to what speeds the Nimitz could go?
Yes, we did. And the answer to that question was, the skipper said, when we get back to port, you can come play at my tennis court.
It's a good one.
But
did you play him at tennis?
Yes. Yes, and he beat me well.
I've heard you say before that you think that operating is the best job on a movie set.
Oh, yeah.
Why do you think that is?
I don't think it is. I know it is. That's how strongly I feel about it. You know, it's the one job where you need to be creative. And that creativity is expressed in terms of composition and camera movement. Now, today, everybody can see what you're doing with the video assist. That's now part of the cameras. And, of course, in the digital world, everybody can see what you're doing anyway with a video camera. But in the days of filming, when we only had film, nobody could see what you were doing except the operator at the moment while you were shooting. And the routine would be simply somebody would say, okay, everybody ready, roll the camera, and the operator would turn the camera on. And from that moment, nobody really knew what was in the frame except the operator. And when someone said cut, they would always turn first to how was it for camera. And usually the operator would give you a thumbs up or a thumbs down. If it was a thumbs down, the director wouldn't want to know why. If it was a minor thing, we would move on. But a good operator really knew when to say it was no good and when to say it wasn't. Then he would turn to sound and say, how was it for sound? Sound would say, good or bad. And then we'd move on. But the idea of having that responsibility, we're talking about thousands of dollars for each shot. I mean, you know, a day shoot in those days was $60,000 a day, you know, for crew and film costs. So let's say, you know, it's going to be much more today, but So here you are, making a shot. Tremendous amount of money rides on the shot. Patience of the actors ride on the shot, because if the operator screws up and we have to do another take, and the actor has just performed one of the best scenes in his life, you can imagine what he's going to have to say to you if you ask for another one.
Mm-hmm.
Usually the actors are allowed to ask for other ones, not the crew.
Right.
So all of these things put together, the pressure of the responsibility, plus the ability to compose the shot, and unlike a still shot, where you can find this composition that's perfect, nothing else is going to move. The camera's not going to move. And you snap the shutter and you've got your shot. Well, in this case, it's not at all the way it is. You know, the camera has to move, the actors start to walk, and you might have rehearsed it 100 times, and you know, well, the actor goes there, and here's exactly where I want my framing. But suppose the actor misses his mark. It happens all the time. You've got to make an adjustment. Well, now the composition's not quite what you had before. And you've always got to make it work at every moment and make it look great. And I used to love that excitement and that challenge as an operator. And most operators feel the same way. But the best thing about it is when someone says wrap at the end of the day, you don't have to go to meetings. You don't have to be responsible for anything. You don't even have to go to dailies if you don't want to. And you come in the next morning with clean hands, and you just sit around and wait until somebody says we're ready for the first shot, and off we go. And you get a little break in between shots, setups. Director of photography works all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Between shots, I'm lighting the next shot, or preparing for the next, or whatever the case may be. Operating is a cushy job, and it's well paid, but it's a very responsible job.
Right. It's well. So why would you become a director of photography if you prefer operator?
So, well, I started on Husbands as a camera operator. And after the first week, I was made cameraman, cinematographer. And it was something that John Cassavetes felt I could do, and he asked me to do. And again, you rise to the challenge. If you're up to it, you rise to it. If not, say, gee, I'd rather stay in a... And I didn't have quite the same feeling about operating then as I have now.
Well, surely on something like Husbands, wasn't a lot of it handheld?
And I was operating a lot still. I mean, that was one thing. I was still holding a camera, particularly when we went to London and did the English sequences.
So I imagine as a director of photography, of course, your operator has to be somebody you trust implicitly.
That's correct. And very often it would be when we move our first assistant up and give him a shot at being an operator. That's how a lot of operators got their jobs.
Mm-hmm.
Most of us in that era came up through the ranks. You know, we were loaders, we were second assistants, we were first assistants, operators, and ultimately, if you chose to do so, you become a director of photography.
What was your camera operator's name on this picture?
Bob Thomas.
That was Bob Thomas?
Yeah. Yeah, Bobby did a lot of pictures with me. Unfortunately, he passed away very young. He was one of the few operators that I could trust implicitly.
Mm-hmm.
He was just great. There's a man who never wanted to become a director of photography.
Really? He was happy?
He turned down opportunities. But he felt then about operating like I do now. One of the reasons that I guess... maybe it's an unconscious one for moving from operator to cinematographer, is that as you get older, you become less able to deal with physically with what you have to do. A hand-holding becomes a burden. Hand-holding and walking or hand-holding and running is even more of a burden. Well, now, of course, there's Steadicam, which makes it easier, but most operators can't use a Steadicam. It takes a specialized training and piece of equipment to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's become a whole new specialty since the days of this picture. That's why if you look back at some of the pictures, most of the cinematographers were relatively older guys.
Right.
You know, they've been through all the hard stuff, and you know, you reap the rewards of your career at that point.
Yeah.
And if you look at the roster of the studios during the studio system, you'll find that all of the cinematographers were older men. In those days, the studios assigned the cinematographers to the pictures.
Yeah.
They put the cinematographer together with an actor who happened to like them, or actress, or whatever. I did not participate in those days, unfortunately. I'd like to have been part of that, but it was before my time.
Really? So you would actually get attached to a particular actor or actress?
Oh, yeah. They always ask for you.
Their glamour or their vanity would dictate that they wanted the right guy for the job.
I mean, once a female star, saw herself on the screen looking smashingly gorgeous, why would she want to ask for someone else, you know, or even permit someone else to photograph her? So it became the routine that cinematographers would cater to the female actresses, because they knew that if they did it right, they'd be asked back on all the pictures.
The Japanese fleet now bears 055 degrees, 162 miles.
Do you want to talk about the notion of shooting while there's a TV in the background?
Oh, you meant the fact that it was flickering? I did not have the sophisticated synchronizing equipment then that we have now. I mean, now it's a snap. We can adjust the shutter speed of the camera now, and with the electronics that are available, it's flickering is a passé problem. Just doesn't happen. But in those days, because the film frame rate was 24, so we had 24 images per second, pulling down, stopping in the camera, and the TV had a different rate of 30. We had that a differential in frame rates. The only way we could do it was to take the film out of the camera, and I put a piece of tissue paper or wax paper in the film gate, and aim it at the TV while the image that we wanted to re-photograph was on the screen, and run the camera. And as the camera ran, I would adjust the shutter manually until the flicker was minimized, and if I really was good at it, I could get the bar to stop at the top or bottom so it wasn't so noticeable. And when you're in a studio or on a stage where the frequency of the power is reliable, you can usually get that to stay for the whole scene. But on board a ship where we're using a generator, and there's nothing really keeping it at 60 cycles. You know, that, it's just not that well controlled. As the speed of the your AC supply would change, that bar would start to drift a little. So every once in a while, you'd see the bar would come right down through the scene while you were rolling. And we can't detect that while we're shooting, but of course we saw it in dailies. And there's no going back on the ship to shoot the scene again.
Of course, yeah.
But my trick with the wax paper usually worked. It worked quite well. It wasn't great, but that was as close to perfection as I could come in those days.
So what else is it about the ship that you learnt while you were on it that you didn't know before? It was different from when you were in the Navy. Because, I mean, this was the Nimitz was...
Well, in its size, for instance, a tidbit would be it's not far in length from the height of the Empire State Building. If you can put that into context, you realize how big that ship is. It had had three movie theaters.
Mm-hmm.
It had. I'm using the past tense. It still has.
It's still in operation.
Yeah. Has many more dining rooms. I don't remember how many than I thought it would need, but then when I learned that the ship holds a little over 5,000 in crew, you start, well, it all starts to fit together, and you realize that you do need that many mess halls, and you do need, it has to be that long to contain all of these people and equipment and aircraft, and the speed of the elevators. I mean, just another little tidbit that's almost meaningless to what we do. How quickly they can get an aircraft from the hangar deck to the flight deck. I mean, it's seconds, it's not minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And they get these things on, their wings are folded, they get them on the deck, and even as they're rolling off the elevator onto the flight deck, everything's unfolding. It's just a spectacle. Mm-hmm. It's wonderful to see.
Now, is there any kind of premiere for this movie that you went to?
No.
It just kind of came out quietly, because from what I understand, it came out, didn't make that much of a splash when it came out,
but it
seems to have grown in popularity.
Well, I think the exciting part of it is, number one, the concept of the time warp, which I think philosophically was done very well. And I think that's what's grabbing audiences today about this film, particularly when they can sit home and watch. I think that the idea of the Zeros versus the Jets is an intriguing concept. And the idea that Tarantino could have survived through both of those eras, you know.
That's right.
Disappeared from the scope.
What? A fun thing about working on a movie set, not peculiar to this film, is calling people, addressing people. And sometimes it gets confusing when you should be addressing them by their character name and you call them by their real name, their given name, and vice versa. It takes me a while to straighten that out in a film. It takes me a few weeks, actually, before I'll start calling a character by the character name when we're supposed to. And protocol is that you should always refer to a character by the character name.
Yes.
But when you address them or call them for their attention, you know, or to give them a mark or something, it's best to call them by their real name.
Is that protocol as well, to call them by their real name if you're addressing them to...
Yeah, I mean, you know, in the case of an actor who can't hit a mark, you know, and you always have to remind him in a rehearsal. You know, if his name is John, you'll call him John and say move up. But if I'm asking the director about where someone should be, I say, well, where do you want the character name to be? I would never say, where do you want John to go? See, the actors have to call their co-actors by their character name, obviously, when they're playing the scene. So it can really create confusion on the set if we don't do the same.
No, I would imagine it's probably the best thing.
And it'll throw them. You know, if they're working on their lines or something, you know, and they're into their heads mentally, just working on something, and they're thinking in terms of characters, it can be really disruptive if you start talking to them about the other actor by their real name rather than the character name.
Yeah. Yeah, I imagine the director would appreciate you keeping them to their character name
yes.
as well, so that they're concentrating on the character.
Yeah, because he's thinking in terms of character.
We have our romantic subplot starting to develop. Mm.
Vector 120. Estimated time of intercept, 0740. Over.
Zulu 5 Bravo. This is Victory 210. 9 minutes to intercept.
Sir, I think you ought to see this. It suddenly appeared behind us.
I don't believe this. It's starting again.
Do you think we can outrun it?
Maybe we ought to be asked.
Of course, the other thing here is that the extras in the film are actually USS Nimitz crew, aren't they?
Yes. Well, in some cases, our crew. We were running short.
And how did you find they responded to being in the movie?
Oh, most of the crew's great about that. You know, they just do it.
And did you find that they were also responsive to having a movie crew on the carrier with
you? Oh, they loved it.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's something about being part of a movie crew that intrigues a lot of people. Most people, I would think. Except the neighbors whose house you're not using, who complain because you're parking in their street. When you're in that house, usually the whole family comes over and your personal friends get invited to see the movie stars and to see the crew.
But the neighbors don't.
Until we leave and they find that their carpet is ruined.
But by then it's too late.
That's right.
Scrap the mission. Get those planes back.
We did a lot of shots like that. Shots of the wake of the ship, you know, and stuff that can be used for this
sequence.
Purpose, yeah. Mm-hmm. But we could grab those shots at any time. That's the only places we were allowed to be when we wanted, if we wanted to get shots on the deck when there were no maneuvers, you know, when they weren't recovering or launching aircraft. I didn't remember that we had that many zeros.
The camera in the F-14 was actually operated by the pilot of the F-14.
Yeah, it actually was a Grumman pilot. I don't even believe it was a Navy pilot, because they're used to that. I mean, they have certain aircraft that are equipped for camera because they do that for their own reasons. They do an awful lot of photography when they want the photographing plane to follow perhaps a new model or a new craft or something, maybe an aircraft that's been repaired, and say, you know, rear elevator was damaged or something. They would fly alongside and watch the action of the elevator, perhaps to see if it was functioning properly. So this fellow who I never met was really experienced in this. He knew how to operate a camera while in flight at very high speed. Now, I don't know where he got the third hand, but because he was flying the aircraft at the same time. But they had cameras mounted on the wings and in the cockpit. And I think that was it. I think there was a camera on each wing and a camera in the cockpit.
Mm-hmm.
But I can't swear to it, because I wasn't part of it.
Right.
It's all hearsay for me.
Dan, get me a damage report.
Right, Skipper. Get a phone check with all stations.
Yes.
Do you still have control of the rudder?
Rich has control of the rudders.
Very well.
All stations, bridge. Phone check.
There they are!
Clear!
Low, on the right.
So of all the locations that you've had to shoot on, would you say that this is one of the most interesting and challenging?
Oh, by far.
Yeah.
Certainly the most exciting.
Mm-hmm.
Just being there when this was happening, when this plane comes wiggling in with this great big hook sticking out its tail. Yeah, the moment he catches, the moment he feels that he's hooked, he's got to pull that throttle back. It's got to be a reflex. You know, you can't think about it. And that's why this training is important. They continually do this over and over again. You know, they featured the Arizona Monument in this shot in Hawaii. And if you've never had the opportunity, you've got to see it. Doesn't matter where you're from or who you are. It's really quite a moving thing, particularly for Americans, to remember what it is for your sons and fathers to defend the country. I mean, it's true of all countries, I guess, but that happens to be an American monument. And
we've already seen the Arizona monuments at the beginning, but we see it at the end as well.
Yeah.
Matt, what the hell's going on here?
Admiral, I don't know where to begin.
Aircraft carrier getting lost in the Pacific Ocean. What kind of Navy is this? I'll never believe it.
Captain, the admirals have departed.
Thank you.
So here we're coming up to a twist ending, which actually, I mean, you voiced concern that people actually understand it.
Yeah.
But I've actually heard also some criticism of this ending, that it's the only bit that seems a bit cheesy in the movie.
Yeah, but everything else from the time warp is gone. Why are they here? You mean that kind of thing?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, well, I had a problem with it.
Really?
Yeah. Not so much when we shot it, but when I saw it put together, I realized that it was what's the expression, cheesy? Is that what you use?
That's the expression I used, yeah.
And you too.
Wait a minute, boy. Here, Charlie, come back here.
But does it surprise you that it's now got a following, even though it didn't necessarily have one?
No, because I knew that I was sure that due to its technical concept and outrageous idea that there could be a time warp, and that they made it work, because I think they made it work conceptually, I think.
Yeah. Yes.
Not always visually, but conceptually, I think it worked. And I knew that people would latch onto that if they're, you know, it's too exciting an idea. And I'm sure that's why the film was made in the first place, because they felt it was.
So do you like the fact that that you're able to now come back and revisit films that you've done in order to, you know, correct them again so that the home movie audience can watch them?
Yeah, it's a privilege as well as a pleasure to do that.
And I assume that being still so active with the cinematography,
the ASC,
the ASC,
not the union, but the ASC.
The ASC, sorry. That you know, it's something you feel strongly that basically cinematographers should be involved in the restoration of these films for DVD.
They should always be involved. I mean, the directors don't seem to want to give too much time to this, to correct, you know, the color correcting and balancing of the DVD. But I know very few directors of photography who would take that attitude. That's why we volunteer our time. We don't get paid to do this. We do this because we want the product to look like it was intended to look. And too many of these DVDs get released without that extra added help.
So would you like to sum up the experience of making the final countdown to close?
It was an experience that I'm sure once in a lifetime, and clearly the most exciting location I've shot.
Okay, great. Thank you very much.